Okay, I'd like to call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting to order. Let the record reflect that it's 3:30 on the dot. We are currently in the Belts Committee Room in Juneau, Alaska. It is Tuesday, February 20th. We want to note members present, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Yunt, both Senator Wilikowski and Senator Bjorkman will be on. I'm Chair Kawasaki. We do have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to thank Carrie from Senate Records and David from the Legislative Information Office for recording and making sure that this is broadcast across the network. Also want to thank Joe Hayes, staff to the Senate State Affairs Committee. On today's agenda, we have two items, a presentation on adding a faculty member to the University of Alaska Board of Regents. There is legislation forthcoming in this body regarding that. We will also have a presentation on the Department of Law overview of their functions and current outstanding litigation. So with that, first we'll go ahead and bring up the issue of adding a faculty member to the UA Board of Regents. We have at least a couple of people here who are either online or in person. Oh, no, they are in person. Okay.
I think there might be one person.
Okay, well, we have Dr. Brian Blitz. He's a UAS professor of mathematics and a member of the UAS Faculty Senate. He's president. We also have Jennifer Ward, UAS professor of library and information sciences, and the former Faculty Alliance chair. Online, we should or might be having at least one other person, a Dr. Matthew Sellar, UAA Associate Professor of Social Work and UAA Faculty President, Senate-elect. I actually don't see him quite online yet, but we welcome Jennifer and Brian. If you'd like to introduce both yourselves and welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Kawasaki and esteemed members of the committee, for giving us this opportunity to present today. As you said, my name is Jennifer Ward. I am library faculty at UAS in Juneau since 2002, and I was the Faculty Alliance chair in the 2023-24 academic year.
I'm Brian Blitz, and I've been at UAS since 2000. And I'm a professor of mathematics, and I am currently the Faculty Senate President at UAS.
Great. And is Matt on the line?
Yes, and it looks like Dr. Matthew Sellar, Associate Professor of Social Work at the University of Alaska Anchorage. If you'd just like to state your name and your affiliation or brief introduction, if you like, welcome to the State Affairs Committee.
Sure. Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Matthew Cuellar. I am an associate professor in the College of Health here at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and I appreciate you all letting me join in via teleconference here. So good to be here. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And if we would like to present, just state your name, and there's both a female and a male presenter, so it's probably not necessary that you reintroduce yourself each time, but proceed.
Okay, this is Jennifer, and you will have received documentation of all of the support we've had on adding a faculty regent position over the last 8 years. This includes the faculty senates, the faculty alliance, student groups at UA, and the United Academics. Some of the reasoning for having a faculty regent is that it would directly benefit the decision-making and governance of the University of Alaska system, with a focus on the quality of our education and how the university serves as an institution for the public good to the state of Alaska. Including a faculty member will provide their depth of experience with education directly working with students with the mission of the university, and especially since we are advocating to appoint an experienced professor and academic with tenure. The faculty education-focused perspective is an important supplement to the business acumen of other regents.
And here's a quote from Mary Wagner. She's a currently an assistant professor of education at UAS, and she's a retired school district superintendent. And you can read as she was a superintendent, she found it very helpful for someone on the school board to have classroom experience and have that sort of in-depth knowledge. And I think that just sort of carries over to the Board of Regents and having a faculty member sort of enlightening or asking good questions about what's going on.
So this is an incomplete list of other universities that have a faculty regent as part of their board. I'll just tell you two examples. The California State University System Board of Trustees includes two faculty members as trustees, and SUNY, the State University of New York System, has 18 members, and they include one student and one faculty member.
And then in terms of benefits of having a student regent, you can read the slide there, but one is you can see the student perspective when issues are coming up, and maybe the most important thing is to have the student talk to the other students and tell them how the board works and how the system operates, and that's a very useful thing. And then more likely than not, those student regents become really good Alaskan citizens. is potentially the best thing about the student regent, I think. As for the faculty regent, I'm going to sort of go through this list. One of the most important things, I think, is when, you know, the Faculty Alliance chair or other governance groups or the chancellors give reports, they're able to ask questions that are relevant to the issues. They're also able to participate and speak through the issues that potentially impact student learning, faculty teaching, and research. And they would be able to participate in the Board of Regents committee work. And certainly we would recuse ourselves if a conflict of interest arose, just as the student regent does. One of the most important things is for the faculty regent to talk to the faculty that aren't regents and let them know how the system's operating, to give both sides a better idea of how these operations work.
Okay, this is Jennifer Ward again. I can speak to how the system currently works. As the Alliance chair, I was allowed 7 minutes to report to the Board of Regents at each of their quarterly meetings. Other than that, I could not speak up at the meetings unless directly asked a question. The one committee that a faculty member serves on as ex officio was on Regent Perdue's Academic and Student Affairs Committee. Again, that was ex officio and did not give me the ability to add to the agenda, and at times still was excluded from some of the conversations on that committee. The Alliance leadership meets with President Pitney and the Vice President of Academic Affairs on a monthly basis, and this is a good relationship, and it's just not adequate enough to communicate issues to and with the regents.
And then just to give you a bit of structure, which you may or may not know, I'm not sure, each of the MAUs, I'll call them, UAA, UAS, and UAF, they all three of them have faculty senates that are separate. And there's a chair-elect, a current chair, and a past chair. And those three people from the three institutions, those are the nine people that make up the Faculty Alliance. and then we rotate through. Jennifer was the Faculty Alliance Chair last year. Someone from Fairbanks is the Faculty Alliance Chair this year. Next year, it'll be someone from Anchorage, and then we just cycle through like that. I think I'll go to the next one.
Okay.
And then in terms of what these entities do, the UA faculty typically has primary responsibility of curriculum development and degree content and stuff like that. The UA administration certainly ensures that the UA mission is met and the policies and practices are followed and whatnot. The board primarily has the responsibility to make sure that the UA stays true to the mission and has enough money to accomplish the mission. And then the faculty union is basically there to protect the faculty working conditions.
So we think the process for selecting a faculty regent should mirror the process for student regents, and that is each of the senates would provide a list of tenured faculty from each of their universities to the Faculty Alliance, and then the Faculty Alliance chair would submit this full list to the governor, and the governor would make the final selection. And like the student regent, we would say this would be a two-year term. And conflicts of interest are going to come up for any regent, whether you're a regular regent or a student regent or a faculty regent, and they have policies and regulations on how to handle this, and regents regularly recuse themselves for any conflicts, and that would be the same case for the faculty regent.
And then we've heard in the past that there was a little bit of a commotion about having a tie vote, and I'm not at all sure that this is even an issue, because in terms of voting and whatnot, it's a majority wins, and so if it's a 6-6 vote, it's not a majority, so it doesn't win. And so I don't think there's any issue there, but that has come up in the past, which is why we're sort of addressing it now.
And as you're probably aware, there are many other types of oversight boards that are made up of similar structures. Hospital boards have doctors on them. The Board of Fish has fishermen on it, that kind of thing. Our Board of Regents, the UA Board of Regents, already includes a student regent. And the Iditarod board includes a musher, which I didn't know until we put together this presentation.
But it makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, so to sum it up, this is a highly supported move forward for the University of Alaska. Communication within the board from the faculty perspective, the very people who are responsible for delivering the education mission of the university, will ensure improved decision-making and governance of the university system. It will help our governing board to have a robust and timely understanding of the needs, processes, and standards of higher education.
That is our presentation.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Ms. Ward and Ms. Dr. Blitz, I'm not sure if Dr. Quillar has any comments he'd like to make before we go to questions.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it. And thank you, Chair Kostaki and members of the Senate State Affairs Committee for giving us the opportunity to present on this topic today. Saying to the Chair, just a couple of things that I just want to reiterate. First, when we think about a faculty regent, particularly here at UAA, it would be a great benefit for our faculty and for our students and for our university here through improved representation, enhanced advocacy for student learning and research, as mentioned, stronger faculty and administration collaboration, protection of academic integrity, and more informed decision-making. Adding a faculty regent to the University of Alaska Board of Regents is in the best interest of the university system, its students, faculty, and overall mission. It'll enhance the UA system's role as a public asset and a catalyst for public good. And this idea has been proposed in the Alaska House for years, and now is the time to make it a reality. So thank you for giving us the opportunity to present today.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Klar. Let's see if there's any questions. I guess I'll start with some questions. I'm pretty familiar with the Board of Regents, pretty familiar with the governance structures at the university. We have a former student regent who's sitting to your right, and I was on the System Governance Council way back in the day. So I recognize the desire to have input in the Board of Regents process. My question is, out of the 11 members of the Board of Regents, there's no current member who is a member of the faculty. And is there anything in law that prevents a member of faculty from being appointed by a governor?
I don't know.
I don't.
To be honest,
know the answer to that.
Okay, I will say that we have a boards and commissions. We have a person in charge of boards and commissions within the cabinet. Governors have come and gone, and from time to time, governors have appointed sort of random people, I guess, people who've applied, people who've asked to be a servant. And I don't know that it would be out of a stretch to be a member of faculty and to be considered a member of the Board of Regents. I don't think there's anything that precludes a member of the within the law serving as a regent. So I'm just curious whether.
I will say I've been here for 25 years, and there hasn't been a member of the Board of Regents that's been a faculty member.
Thank you. And I think when John Davies might have been, was he staff, I guess, considered, or was he faculty? But he was retired by that point. So
yeah.
I don't know, actually, if that's the case. Let's see if there's any questions from other members. Any questions for either of these two? As I mentioned earlier, there will be potential legislation by this committee. So we will have future hearings. But if anybody has any questions at this point, there's two folks who are experts on the topic. I will ask another question then regarding a regent. Why wouldn't you want to just designate a faculty regent, a full 8-year term, and one of the members of the 11 on the board? There has been, for instance, legislation that designated that there should be a person from the MATSU, because the MATSU had been underrepresented in prior administrations or prior years. And I think there was a thought that they needed to make sure that it had some geographic differentials. So has there been any thought to that?
Yeah, I'll speak to that. I guess one of the reasons that we wouldn't want it to be an 8-year thing is we would want several disciplines and several institutions being represented in those 8 years. You know, so having four different people in those 8 years gives a little bit of a variety of representation there. And then, you know, on the flip side, if someone's going to be on the Board of Regents and as a faculty member, they're giving up something from their faculty workload. And so 2 years is enough to, you know, give up their research or give up a teaching a class or whatever it might be, right, in order to be on the Board of Regents. So those are sort of the two sides to that coin, I think.
Okay. let's see. Any other final questions? I don't need to open up public testimony, but if anybody wants to, Joe, former student regent, wants to say anything. We've seen this bill bounce around from time to time. It's been a couple legislatures now. I appreciate that history and showing some of the, especially new members, some of that history. We did not invite the Board of Regents, and we did not invite the staff or administration of the university. But I do know that in prior years, when there was discussion on this particular topic, they were not in favor of it. Do you know why they would not be in favor of a proposal to have a member of faculty as a permanent or two-year member of a Board of Regents. Or I don't even remember what they said was the reason. I wasn't on a committee at the time. So.
I mean, I would assume they would think that it would be a conflict of interest. I don't believe that, but I assume that that's what they might think. And I don't know, in the past, I'll say 10 years, the union and the administration have been fighting pretty good. So
yeah,
it's not too surprising that...
Yeah, I could speculate, but I don't know for sure. But there may be the perception that it would be easier not to have a faculty regent, that the structure that it is as it is, you know, status quo. But I would argue that it would be easier to have that faculty representation there, and that would improve the communication between faculty and administration and the understanding of the faculty to have that representation on the board.
Okay. Yeah, and I didn't mean to put words in the mouth of the administration.
I'm not putting any words in anybody's mouth.
I didn't
mouth.
Want to. Yeah, I get that. I wanted to ask the question, so I kind of forced you into it. But I do appreciate the comments that have been made, and I do know that when we will see a bill in a future hearing that I suspect they will testify on behalf of the administration, on behalf of the Board of Regents, and I'm sure you will too. So, any other questions for the two before we move on to our next topic? All right, you're off the hook. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Dr. Matthew Quillar, Dr. Brian Blitz, and Jennifer Ward.
Thank you.
At the university, and we will see you shortly at another meeting.
Sheesh.
Sheesh. We'll take a brief at ease and spin up the next Department of Law. Take a brief at ease. All right, the Senate State Affairs Committee is back to order. We have with us next the presentation from the Department of Law. The Department of Law, this will be a brief overview of sort of what the Department of Law does, sort of current cases that are pending. We appreciate Deputy Attorney General from the Civil Division, Corey Mills, being present. If there's other folks that decide to come online, then we'll hear from them later. But if you would like to introduce yourself to the committee, and welcome to the Senate State Affairs.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. Again, Corey Mills, Deputy Attorney General over the Civil Division for the Department of Law. As the chair pointed out, I was asked to kind of give an overview and look at kind of the current situation, especially around litigation. A lot of the slides are kind of reused from another House overview we did, but I'm going to try to hone in more on the litigation aspect of things. So I'm going to start with that overview, kind of get into the specific areas we deal with, because it is a very broad book of legal business, I'd say, that we do, just so that the committee can then dig in a little bit. If you have questions along the way, please feel free to interrupt. So I just want to ground everyone in kind of what the Civil Division does. One way we describe our mission is providing high quality legal services to the executive branch. And that's through every sort of legal type job you could think of. We do litigation, agency advice, we do research, legislative drafting, regulatory review. So if you can think of things attorneys do, we probably have an attorney who does it. So getting into that, you can really think of the Civil Division in particular as the biggest law firm, civil law firm in the state in some ways. We have around 144 attorney positions. within the civil division, about 250 employees total. And this chart shows we have to bill our hours, similar to a private law firm. So this actually breaks out the number of hours we spent in fiscal year 2024 by the different departments. So you can see that we end up doing work for every department in state government. A couple things to point out briefly. If you look, the Department of Public Safety looks like it doesn't get a lot of legal help. That's because most of the legal help comes from the criminal division. There's actually two attorneys in the criminal division that advise the Department of Public Safety, and not just prosecution, but on their kind of day-to-day work. But we do help out a little bit. But that's why that sliver is so small. Our largest is the Department of Family and Community Services. Why is that? They have the Office of Children's Services. They have API, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Our mental commitments happen through that department. So that's why that's the largest kind of chunk. That's the most number of hours. And our child protection section, and you'll see that later, our child protection section within the Department of Law, which represents the Office of Children's Services, makes up about 40% of our workforce. So it is the vast majority of the work we do. And so otherwise, you kind of see that the work gets divided up between all the departments for all the various types of work. I also had the had our staff divide up those same number of hours, but instead of by department, I divided it by what we may call core mission categories or core categories of legal representation. So the largest chunk is legal representation. That is courtroom litigation. So when you see that chunk, it's really what you think of as a typical attorney on the TV shows. So that is the largest amount of what we do. Then we have advice, of course, which an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Legislation, regulations, protecting the public can also be categorized in some ways as litigation. This is our consumer protection work. For example, our work before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska representing the public interest. So that's another, we call it protecting the public because it's a little bit different. We're in a little more of an advocacy role for the public there than we are in just representing the various departments. So with that, our civil division organization, just to get a sense of how we operate, you'll see each of the green boxes here represents kind of a different component. These are budget components, actually. And then under each of them is our different sections. So now I'm going to go kind of into each of those components and what those sections do so you can get an idea of the type of litigation and work that those sections have. So resource development and infrastructure, I think this is fairly straightforward. I think it's an area that the legislature, you know, engages a lot with, hears a lot about, more in the news than some of our other sections. And they, you know, this can range from our environmental section, which is helping to bring enforcement actions on our various environmental laws. But they also have permits, for example, that they do, and then defending those permits in court if someone sues. That's the type of work you might see there. So both proactive as well as more defensive litigation. Department of Transportation, a lot of the litigation here is actually like condemnation proceedings, right? So Department of Transportation is trying to go out, trying to build a project. Sometimes they have to give someone just compensation for land so that they can finish that project. But then otherwise, you have the whole range of litigation here from National Environmental Policy Act, documentation, a lot of defense litigation. So the proactive is usually like the condemnation. Defensive is someone challenges some project that the department is doing. Oil and gas, again, this can be both proactive and defensive. So we do collections. So we file lawsuits to go after and make sure we get our fair share of royalties and taxes. And then we also are in the defensive, you know, same sort of thing when you're dealing with leases and oil and gas companies. Lots of litigation can occur in that arena, especially when you're dealing with a large part of what the state's budget comes from. And then natural resources, same sort of thing. This is more the area, I'd say, where we've talked a lot about this statehood defense type idea. That generally falls into our natural resources arena. But then they also deal with all the fish and game work. So anything from Board of Fisheries, Board of Game, any defensive litigation on that front, and then any permitting that the Department of Natural Resources or Fish and Game do, and then, you know, a lawsuit may arise, they're also representing the departments in that litigation. Much more, we have proactive litigation there, but I'd say that's very defensive. You know, we're sued, we have to respond. Health, safety, and welfare. So child protection, I already spoke about this section. They make up, when I pulled the numbers over the last couple of years, on an annual basis, we have around 5,000 litigation matters going on within a year. 3,000 of them are child in need of aid proceedings representing the Office of Children's Services. So they are literally in court. They're more like criminal attorneys. They're in court all the time, whether over the phone or in court in person. But this is a constant court appearance, multiple parties involved, you know, always trying to come to resolution when they can. And then, of course, the termination of parental rights is kind of the last resort if we have to go there. This also results in a lot of appeals. And so later I'll talk about our appellate section. And we have, you know, about a 90% success rate on those appeals. But again, most of our appellate work, most of our litigation work comes from this area. Human services. So human services from a litigation standpoint, again, they're public assistance. I think everybody knows litigation that's been going on with our public benefits and the backlogs that have been experienced. So, of course, we're representing the department in that regard. This is also the section, though, that does like mental commitments. So tries to, you know, protect individuals or protect others from individuals if they're a harm to self or others. And so this is the section that will go and work with the Alaska Psychiatric Institute and the department on doing those sorts of things. And then they also have some protection of vulnerable adults through guardianship and conservatorship, ensuring people who cannot advocate for themselves have an advocate through a guardian or conservator. Jeff Waller, he heads up our regulatory affairs and public advocacy. Very technical area, have to love math, but it's an important role. He keeps the utility rates. He and his section really keep the utility rates in a reasonable range for Alaskans. They're constantly sitting at the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and determining, is this right? Is this a reasonable rate? And so they participate in a lot of the larger proceedings before the RCA. Special litigation and appeals. Special litigation really can represent any number of departments. These are our specialized litigators, the people who know how to deal with complex litigation, you know, weighty constitutional issues, quick elections matters where we have to get from Superior Court to the Supreme Court in a week's time. This is the section. They usually have a subject matter expert on the case from another section, and then they will handle the litigation and see it through to completion. They are also the section that enforces our consumer protection and antitrust laws. So our consumer protection unit lives in special litigation, and that's because a lot of the work they do is special litigation. It's either multi-state, dealing with antitrust issues, dealing with or consumer protection lawsuits like our opioid litigation around the opioid crisis. You know, recently I think we've had some auto dealership issues that we've had to deal with. We've had a motorhome company that we feel was violating our consumer protection laws and our goal is to, in a lot of those cases, is to get restitution back to the consumers as much as possible. And then the state will also receive a payment or penalty in those cases. Opinions, appeals, and ethics. Again, they're kind of the funnel. Once it goes through Superior Court, our appellate section will take that on at the higher courts, Alaska Supreme Court, Ninth Circuit, anything like that. So from a litigation perspective, they're kind of the pinnacle. Like I said, most of their work is child protection cases, and they also do a number of mental commitment appeals is another kind of steady flow from their appellate work. Government services, I'm not going to focus too much on these because these are not litigation heavy. This is our legislation and regulation section. And then our professional development and public service really oversees our fellowship and internship program. They kind of try to take part in all of the various pieces within the department. And then our information and project support section, otherwise known as IPS. They advise on Public Records Act, disclosure of information. They run our e-discovery system. They're kind of the backbone behind everything, helping make sure that our document management is where it needs to be. Civil defense litigation. Another big portion of our litigation portfolio is doing work with risk management, representing the state in tort lawsuits. You have a slip and fall on the sidewalk, you know, that's owned by the state. We would have to come in and represent the state and defend the state in that lawsuit. We also defend the state as an employer in workers' compensation claims as well. And then lastly, the other area where we have, I'd say, one of our largest caseloads of civil lawsuits is the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections gets sued a lot. It's part of being a Department of Corrections, and inmates have a lot of time, too. So we get a lot of litigation. I think we're at like 250 lawsuits sitting with us right now just against the Department of Corrections. So this section kind of does all of that civil litigation defense work where we are sued and we have to come in and represent the state. So this is highlights. You know, I don't know if I need to go through this too much. You know, I kind of want to leave it open to questions or areas that people are interested in. I think I kind of went over the caseloads, but if you're interested in these, this just kind of gives an overview of some of the major things that we went through last year in our various components. And otherwise, happy to kind of take questions or know where you want to go.
Great. Thank you. thank you, Corey. We do have some questions, I think. So who wants to be first? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Good to see you, Corey. Mm-hmm. How many attorneys are there in the Department of Law?
So total with criminal and civil, I think we're at, it's a little under 300.
And if I could, Mr. Chair. Yeah. How many do you need? Is that enough, or do you need more or less?
Well, for the civil division, That's a good question. We're always kind of looking at where we're growing. You know, our corrections caseload, for example, is really busting out of the seams right now, and we're working with the Department of Corrections on that. But overall, I think we're in a pretty good spot. I don't want to speak for criminal. You know, I think there's a twofold issue when you talk about positions. One is just where we're at in the legal field. Our vacancies have gone, we have a much better vacancy rate than we did about 3 years ago, thanks to the legislature and the increase in salaries. We've also on the civil side been able to create more flexibility with telework and flex scheduling for families, which I think has been very successful. But ultimately, there aren't enough law students coming out of law schools. So we end up competing with private sector, federal government, all the other public sector. And so we used to have, on average, you know, 20 applicants for every job. If we get three, we're feeling pretty good right now. And that also means that the attorneys we're getting are less experienced. So we're getting a lot more either straight out of law school, straight out of a clerkship. Great, very promising attorneys. It takes a lot of work to mentor and get attorneys up to speed and where they need to be. That's why we created the professional development and public service section, was to specifically focus on professional development of young attorneys and take that off of the supervisors. So just in short, it's sort of a two-edged sword, where it's not only positions, it's also retention and making sure the people we get stay on long enough to be able to be as productive as we need them to be.
Follow up.
What is the average salary for these attorneys, and what is the average turnover rate? If you know.
So salaries, I'm going to have to look at where they are now. Most of our attorneys right now are what we call attorneys, if I look at the spread, as attorneys threes and fours, which means they have four or less years of experience for the most part. And I just don't have it off the top of my head what they came in at, but I'm happy to get that to the committee. What was your second? You had a second question on salaries and then...
Turnover rate.
I haven't run that for this year. Again, we're... So 3 years ago or 4 years ago when we looked at this, we had lost 93... on the civil division, 93 of 144 attorneys over like a 5-year span. And that was COVID, the COVID time frame. Recently, we're doing much better. The turnover I'm seeing is much more, you know, we have retirements. We're heading towards a huge retirement pool. I think we have 25 attorneys that could retire in the next 5 years. So I feel like we've had a pretty good stint for about 4 years, but I see that turnover more in terms of large amount of retirement, and then just we're still competing with that private sector. But I don't have specific numbers on me, but I can go back and look at exactly what it's been the last 4 years.
And the committee will relay those questions in a document, okay. And so we'll ask those questions, and we'll pass it on to the rest of the members of the committee. Did you want to follow up, Senator Wilkowski?
I have some more, unless others have questions. I'm happy to defer, Mr. Chair.
No, just go ahead.
Okay. So how many cases use outside counsel?
Ooh, again, I don't have that on me right now. Most of our cases are not outside counsel. Like, I'd say the vast majority are in-house. The cases, you know, when it comes to like oil and gas, there are times when we use outside counsel for litigation, and then some of our higher profile cases, or just frankly when workloads get down. For example, we entered into a contract to help with our tort litigation. That's not something we would normally do, but that's when our vacancy rate was down to, we only had two attorneys doing the entire workload of six. And so we had gotten outside counsel. We're kind of finishing up that contract, but those cases just take a long time. So, you know, the categories where we use outside counsel are, like I said, when we just have a workload problem. And we had that, I'd say we had more outside counsel 4 years ago than we have now. The second is special expertise in certain areas. And then the third is some of those more high-profile, you know, complex or weighty issues where we want to bring in someone that may have more experience, for example, in federal appellate courts.
And do you anticipate fewer cases against the federal government with the new federal administration?
Through the chair, that's a great question. One we've been grappling with ourselves. I would say any answer I give today is probably a little bit of a crystal ball, just because I think we're still seeing where things settle. What we're getting right now is a lot of requests for continuances and stays. I mean, similar to the last administration. You know, they want to get their feet under them. They want to figure out what they want to do. But we haven't gotten a direction on exactly where they're going to go. So I don't want to make any promises. But here's, if I'm going to use a crystal ball and take Corey's prediction for what it's worth, I think we'll see an increase in litigation in that area over the next 2 years, only because we have an existing 80 plus cases that are not going to go away right away. And then we're going to see more litigation brought from other parties that then the state's going to have to decide, do we want to be involved in this? And then after that 2 years, I think we'll start seeing more of a decline and kind of evening out to a baseline, if that makes sense. But that's kind of where, again, my spidey sense is leading at the moment.
Go ahead, Senator Wilkowski.
A question on a specific case that I've got I've gotten from a number of constituents, Texas versus Becerra, that deals with, your count three seeking Section 504 is unconstitutional. Are you withdrawing that claim, is my understanding?
So through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we haven't withdrawn it yet, but yesterday, and I'm happy to provide this to the committee, we actually filed with the other, I think we're at 13 or 14 states that we filed with. We filed a status conference, a joint status report, which is normally not something important. But in that status report, we took an opportunity to clarify what that claim meant and what it doesn't mean. And so, again, happy to provide this to the committee, but we wanted to clarify that the plaintiffs have never moved. We don't plan to move. The court to declare to enjoin or enjoin Section 504. We don't think that Section 504 is unconstitutional on its face. We don't think the statute should ever be overturned. The claim, which I admit may have not been very artfully drafted, was meant to be an as-applied challenge to the rule. So if the rule, for some reason, does fit within the Rehabilitation Act, we don't think that interpretation of the Rehabilitation Act is constitutional.
And just if I could...
Go ahead, Senator Wilkowski.
People listening may have no idea what we're talking about. Maybe we should provide some context. But fundamentally, Section 504 prohibits all entities that receive federal funding from discriminating against disabled people. Is that correct?
Yes. Okay. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that's absolutely correct.
And to add on to that, that would include approximately 15% of all the students in the state of Alaska who are on an IEP. That's roughly 20,000 kids in K-12 potentially, right?
So through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I don't have those particular numbers, but what I can tell you is that funding stream is not at risk from this lawsuit. We want all those funds to keep going out. In fact, our concern about the rule that was passed and what the lawsuit is about is actually that the way the rule interprets Section 504, especially under Medicaid, is it creates inconsistencies between Medicaid and Section 504 that make it nigh impossible to meet the standards outlined, which means you'll have providers deciding they're not going to provide those services because the thresholds are too high, the standards are too high. What we want to do is go back to what it was and keep the funding streams going, keep the providers out there so that people can be served. And this is a very, it's complicated. I don't want to get too far into it because I feel like I only know enough to be dangerous, but we do not intend to stop the funding flow. We want everything that was happening prior to continue. It's just this rule actually makes it infeasible to provide the services in the way the federal government was trying to mandate.
Right.
And I'll just say
I appreciate that. In looking at your claim for relief, though, in count three, I know you said you're not seeking to declare Section 504 unconstitutional. Your claim three says, quote, Section 504 is unconstitutional. That's exactly what it says. And in the way I read it and the way many people who advocate for people with special needs, for the disability community, have interpreted it as a blanket striking down of Section 504, which is exactly what you say. So, but you're saying now on the record that is not what you're seeking.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, exactly. And I'm really glad you asked the question because we want to be clear. That is not what we meant. We agree it was inartfully drafted in the complaint. We have now filed something with the court clarifying that that is not what we want to do. So there is now a court document on file explaining that that's, you know, under penalty of perjury, that that's not what we want.
Do you want to continue?
I have other questions if nobody else has any.
Do you want
to? I have one question.
Okay. We'll switch to Senator Bjorkman for a second. You can cool down. Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, our state caps amount awards for non-economic relief and torts for wrongful death at $400,000 and for personal injury at $1 million. How would changing those caps to better reflect an actuarial value of someone's life or limb affect the Department of Law?
Through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, I don't think it would necessarily directly affect the Department of Law. It would affect all of those calculations affect the state budget and our risk management pool. I mean, that's what it comes down to is, you know, if those caps were increased, then more cases would reach that cap. And so you'd have more damages being given out. That said, I think we are pretty successful at keeping those down when it's appropriate, you know, and making sure that the damages that we're paying out either through settlement or judgments are within the proper range. But again, if you increase the cap, you increase the amount of money going out the door, and the state is often you know, we're easy to sue. The state is easy to sue, and we usually have the money. And so you're just going to see more lawsuits, and you're going to see potentially more money paid out. And to me, that's a policy call as to what the legislature and the executive branch want to do.
Follow up, Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you for that answer. do you think that if we adjusted the caps to maybe reflect a more accurate actuarial value of someone's life or limb, that might change behavior of industry or state agency or others to avoid killing and hurting people?
Through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, I think I'm just as qualified as all of you to answer that question. You know, I think all of those levers make differences in decisions. If you look around the world, frankly, we're one of the more litigious societies on this planet currently. So I don't know how much it's going to affect, because things happen. We're people. Things are going to happen. So I don't know how much it'll move the needle. I just don't know.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I'll bring up another actually, just to follow back up on the 504 issue, mm-hmm. because it has sort of caused a lot of concern, mm-hmm. and that the state of Alaska, along with, I don't know, there's 16 other plaintiffs, had requested of the courts to declare Section, it's been very clearly says, declare Section 504 unconstitutional, I think causes a lot of alarm. Mm-hmm. When the state decides to join, how are those decisions made? Mm. Are you reading what goes on? Is the attorney general, is the governor saying, I'd like you to join on, these states have joined on for this reason? It just seems pretty clear that I don't know if it wasn't really read, but how does that happen, and how do we decide that how does the agency, mm-hmm. the attorney general, decide that where to join and when to?
Yeah. Chair Kawasaki, great question. So in these multi-state contexts, we have a decision-making process that usually involves the attorney general consulting with the governor. At the end of the day, is this something we feel that really impacts state interest? Is it something we think is important to the state? And so it's kind of a, you know, we're providing legal services to the executive branch, and so it's a consultation, and we review it internally. We have an attorney assigned to this case. Of course, when you're dealing with multi-states, it's a lot of parties to try to bring together to draft things. It's unfortunate that this case hasn't, you know, gotten to the point where we have really, you know, drafted a full briefing. This is a complaint, which is just required to be a notice pleading, you know, putting everyone on notice about what we might argue. So I think if we had gotten to the briefing stage, you would have seen a lot more clarity in that. Like I said, looking back, we understand it was inartfully drafted. Exactly how this one occurred, I'm not privy to that. But basically, we decide whether the core claim in the case is something we care about, and then we go and we assign a lead attorney who then works with the other states on how to make sure that our interest is adequately represented and providing comments and switching around drafts. Again, drafting by committee can be its own lovely process, but that's usually how it goes.
So to follow up, Ms. Mills, the attorney general is the one that signs off on these, and is that what you're saying, that the attorney general makes that decision solely?
Yes, Senator Kawasaki, in consultation with the governor, but ultimately it's the attorney general's decision. We do not join any multi-state lawsuit without the attorney general's approval.
And then through the, I guess, when delving down, you find that maybe Section 504 is something that you do not want to declare unconstitutional for various good reasons, disabled veterans, children on ILPs. But the fundamental reason then, of course, there was an issue here discussing gender ideology or gender promotion, otherwise, I guess, gender ideology. So that's the reason why the Attorney General decided to sign on to this particular brief, which strikes down Section 504. Is that correct?
Chair Kawasaki, no. Actually, our interest was not in that provision. Our interest was in the part of the rule that dealt with adopting the most integrated setting and the at serious risk of institutionalization of standards of care. That was the portion of the rule that we had the most concerns about, because trying to meet the metrics that they set out in that requirement, puts providers in a very difficult position. And it was very vague, and the burdens created made it pretty impossible for a lot of providers to meet the standard that they set out. So that was the fundamental concern from the state's perspective in consultation with the Department of Health, as well as looking at some of our case law in this area. We think they completely mischaracterize what's called the Olmstead decision that deals with these issues, and they went way beyond it in a way that again just makes it infeasible, especially for a state as vast as Alaska, with a lack of certain mental health community services at the community level. And again, you put the burden on the provider taking Medicaid to meet these standards, and the threat was that your funding could be taken away if you didn't meet the standard.
Okay, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. I think one of the biggest issues in front of the state, certainly 70% of the state that receives its energy from Cook Inlet, natural gas, is the fact that we may run out of natural gas soon. And according to the USGS, there's 19 trillion cubic feet of gas in Cook Inlet. There, when Hilcorp acquired the originally the assets there, and then again expanded that in a few years later, they now control 90% of the leases there. And the Federal Trade Commission was concerned that this would they could exert their market influence to increase prices, to withhold gas for utilities and consumers. And the state agreed to a consent decree, as I'm sure you're aware. Mm-hmm. And part of that consent decree gave the Attorney General the authority and the power to look at their books, to make sure they were complying with their obligations to drill, to produce, to explore. I know the utilities sent a letter to the Attorney General probably a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, And I asked the head of one of the utilities just a couple of weeks ago if he had ever received a response, and he said no, he hadn't. And I'm just curious, and I along with, well, I've sent letters to the Attorney General along with others asking him to investigate. There's a tremendous concern about potential antitrust and about potential that this company was not living up to the terms of its consent decree. The Attorney General had the power to investigate that, had the obligation to investigate that, and I'm curious if he ever undertook any investigation or ever undertook any efforts to make sure that the consumers who rely on gas, 70% of the population of the state, whether he took any efforts to make sure they were being protected from potential antitrust behavior.
So through the chair, Senator Willikowski, I'm going to give an answer that I know you're probably not going to like. We really are not able to talk about whether we're investigating or not. That's under the consumer protection and antitrust laws. What I can tell you is that regardless of that consent decree, we have the authority. So even if the consent decree did expire, I think you're aware of that. Regardless of that consent decree, if there is an antitrust violation, we can investigate. And the fact that the consent decree expired doesn't change that. Of course, when it comes to that provision you cited, you know, that really had to do with kind of a duty to produce, to ensure production, that's something that we would actively consult with the Department of Natural Resources on, because they're the experts in that area. Our consumer protection attorneys are not. So that would be the partnership that would be formed. I can't talk about specifics, but that's kind of what we would rely on to gain that information.
Senator Willikowski.
And last year when the legislature, the Senate Resources Committee, adopted an amendment to close the S-Corp loophole, which would impact, we think, Hillcorp, they sent a very threatening letter, which basically threatened to shut down production in Cook Inlet if the state did not rescind that action. And several days later, the legislature did rescind that action. That seems to me to be fundamentally using their market power in a coercive manner, which would cause potential catastrophe for 70% of the state. And I hope that the Attorney General will look very, very closely at any sort of similar behavior that might occur this time around. Because we've heard, and maybe you can clarify this for me, well, I guess I'd like your response on the record about whether the Attorney General will be monitoring that situation.
So through the chair, Senator Willikowski, I was not aware of the, was it testimony or a letter? Is there a document that Hillcorp provided?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll look back at that in the record, but happy to take a look at that and take that back to the Attorney General.
Go ahead, Senator Willikowski.
On the issue of education funding, mm-hmm. can you outline, if to the extent you know, what is the state's obligation to adequately fund education? And do you believe we're in compliance with that, the court orders in Moore and Casale?
Through the chair, Senator Willikowski, all the loaded questions today, huh? So I think you cited to the most important cases. There was also one a lot longer ago that I'm not remembering. Hooch. Thank you. The Hooch case. So we really haven't gotten definitive guidance from the courts on what amounts to, when it comes to education, the funding. In fact, in Moore, that's not an element that she got into. She didn't opine on whether the funding was correct. She opined on the outcomes and then kind of gave it back to the state to say, you need to intervene here and figure something out. And then, of course, we came to a settlement. And in both of those cases, we came to a settlement. Casale, of course, had to do with treating our rural REA districts equally to our school districts in terms of maintenance and the building of facilities. And again, the court found that you can't give a bunch of money to urban school districts and leave the rural school districts out when the legislature is kind of the school board for purposes of our rural school districts. They don't have a revenue stream. So, you know, to your question, I don't think we have an answer from the court. I don't even think we have guidance from the court. And I think you saw that in Moore, that she didn't get into that issue. So I don't think we have, there's not a firm number that I think we can draw on at this point.
Okay.
I know, really satisfactory answer.
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Thank you for the answer, though. I will go ahead and just ask another question. This is regarding some folks that we just talked about recently. A couple years ago, the Kenai grand jury was in the process of investigating corruption in both the judicial branch and perhaps the Department of Law. The Supreme Court had intervened at that time with some rules about what grand juries can and can't do. I wanted to hear your opinion on that rule, and I guess what it has meant for folks that would like to open up and, I guess, you know, ultimately expose potential corruption. Mm.
Chair Kawasaki, that has been more my counterpart's deal, only because the prosecutors are the ones that present to the grand jury. But all of management at the Department of Law is aware at this point, partly because what the Supreme Court did was basically give the gatekeeping function to the Attorney General. So the Attorney General determines whether a petition or application to open a grand jury investigation, which is different than like a grand jury that's indicting. This is a different process under our Constitution, gave that gatekeeping function to the Attorney General. Since then, we have received several applications. I can't remember how many. A few of them have resulted in grand juries being convened for investigatory purposes. A few of them, I think, have been denied because they didn't meet the threshold. But we have developed what we're in the process of doing now is trying to make the best of the situation. We've been told by the Supreme Court we're supposed to do this. I don't believe it's where we would have liked to have landed, but it's where we're at. So we're trying to create a transparent process for members of the public to be able to submit applications that we can then review. And what we do currently is we have a committee, some criminal attorneys, some civil attorneys that haven't been involved at all in whatever the allegations are, review the information, determine whether it meets what we call the threshold of what the Constitution says a grand jury investigation should be able to be conducted on, and that's handed up to the Attorney General for a final decision. So that's our current process, and what we're trying to do now is just make it as public and transparent as possible, and then people can comment from there.
Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on Senator Kawasaki's line of questioning, I believe you were party to a meeting with some of my constituents very recently, and you were asked questions in this vein as to who is responsible. Mm-hmm. So when folks feel like they have credible claims of corruption, either with someone at the Department of Law or a judge or someone in the judicial system, Alaskans want to know that those claims that they feel are credible are investigated by someone, and if there is cause to bring a charge forward, that's done. A constituent of mine has made some statements about what happened at that meeting. Mm-hmm. Could you just tell the committee and the public who is responsible for investigating credible claims of corruption within the court system and the Department of Law?
So through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, so there's several layers here, right? So first, law enforcement can always investigate criminal conduct. So if someone really believes that corruption rises to the level of a crime, you can go to law enforcement and seek law enforcement to investigate that crime. So that's one avenue. Another avenue for the justice system, or at least judges, is we have a judicial conduct commission, a commission on judicial conduct. That's another place where you can raise a complaint. Attorneys, if you are concerned that attorneys aren't meeting their ethical obligations, you can file a complaint with the Alaska Bar Association. And there's a whole process for getting those resolved. If you believe that state government there's some corruption or procedural or systemic corruption, we also have the Ombudsman's Office, which you can also file complaints in, and they will look into that. They're actually housed within the legislative branch so that they're not conflicted with the executive branch and can look into those things. And then we kind of come to this investigative grand jury process, which there is a constitutional provision, allowing for these. I believe the terms, I know it has to do with public safety and public welfare, I think are the two terms that the Constitution. And so it's not meant to be about a specific criminal case or a specific case that someone feels they were wronged on. It really is meant to be public safety and public welfare more generally. At least that's kind of how it's been interpreted. And so if a member of the public has an issue in any of those veins, I think those are all avenues they can go through. And if they feel an investigative grand jury to have members, their peers, kind of review something, again, we will be working towards having a much more public process. But even now, you can send us information on why you think it needs to happen. And that is something we will take seriously and look into.
That's it. Yes, go ahead. Senator York.
Thank you again. Thank you for that answer. I am interested from your perspective at law what a legislative fix is for prescribing the beginning of how an investigative grand jury begins, who is in charge of it, and how they can be separate from the judicial system and the Department of Law. Many people engage through the avenues that you just described with things that they have not felt hurt over or have felt aggrieved about. Horrible situations that on its face are bad, but they don't get satisfaction in their case. People's children have been taken away. People have lost their livelihood. The list goes on. I am very interested in there being a legislative remedy to prescribing how an investigative grand jury begins and the process and forms in which it takes. I don't think that the gatekeeper should be the Attorney General. I think it needs to be something else somewhere else. I would like to know what your recommendations are for how that process begins and what it looks like, please.
Through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, I think we can both agree we don't think the Attorney General should be the gatekeeper. So we can start there. Beyond that, I will say that we do have someone in our office who is specifically looking at this, looking at how we can make what we have now more transparent. She was also in that meeting you referenced, as well as what might be options down the line. I don't have an answer right now in front of me to give you, but we're happy to continue those discussions. And it is something that is still front of mind for us, trying to figure out what that might look like.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Some states have elected attorney generals, for instance. And so it's a very different situation that we have here in the state. And legislators get investigated. We have a legislative ethics committee, and it has some members who are on them, and it has a bunch of lay folks who are on them, and they get all sorts of complaints every day about what we do. and that's a good thing. It's a check and balance, and it is the right of a citizen to be able to challenge something that we as legislators might do, and it's something that's outside of our scope or our ability to even have any control over as legislators. So if somebody thinks we're breaking the law, then they come to the legislative ethics and have a process. Let's see. Did you, Senator Willikowski has a question.
Yeah, thank you. Just if you could just real briefly talk about prosecutorial delays. I know you're sure you saw the article in Pro Anchorage Daily News, ProPublica, about the delays in prosecutions. And the one case in particular was a sexual assault, broad daylight, 2017. Police officers witnessed it. Others witnessed it. Had DNA evidence, and it had 50 delays, and it wasn't brought to trial until 7 years later. And they noted that in a recent 12-month period, only 7 criminal cases went to trial within the 120-day limit. And can you talk about what – do you need anything from the legislature to speed that up, or do you think you've got this situation fixed?
So through the chair, Senator Willikowski, I am definitely not the person to talk about that. But I do know that our Director Kemp and Deputy Attorney General Skidmore have been addressing that in other hearings. I will, you know, just kind of reiterate some of the things they say, but I would definitely encourage you to talk to them or have them before this committee. That it's, you know, the delays, we don't want the delays. The Department of Law doesn't want the delays. And so what we're doing now is just making sure that we document, we're ready. We want to go to trial. To try to make a record of that so that it's clear that this is not what we want. We want to pursue these. There's many reasons for delays. I would leave it at that and let you kind of hear from them on the various factors that they've been dealing with, along with the court system and defense, just the whole criminal justice system moving, especially post-COVID.
Are there any other questions for Deputy Attorney General Mills? Well, once again, we'd like to thank you on short notice for being here, for being present, and for answering questions. We will follow up with you and with the department with other questions. And we would like you to send our regards to the Attorney General who wasn't able to make it today. This concludes the meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee. The next meeting is scheduled for Thursday, February 25th? Tuesday, February 25th. Is that right? Tuesday, February 25th. Right. We will hear a second hearing on Senate Bill 43. That's Women's History Month by Senator Gray Jackson. A first hearing on Senate Bill 40, which is Hispanic Heritage Month. And we will also have a first hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 6, Washington, D.C. Statehood by Lukey Tobin. And a first hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 10, Hmong Veterans and the Congressional Gold Medal by Senator Willikowski. We will also have open and invited public testimony during those three hearings. If there's no other business to come before the committee, once again, thank you very much for being here. And the meeting is adjourned now at 4:50.